Hello, welcome to ATM, Artists Talk Movies, a podcast interviewing creatives about films that have inspired and or influenced their personal studio work. I'm Hyde Fontenot, and I'm here with co-host Aaron Stafford.
We're here to talk about contemporary art and the creative impulse with new guests each episode. We're having casual conversations.
We don't pretend to be authorities.
We're hoping to give you a window into the visionary process of makers.
The City Council of Blaine gave me the responsibility of putting together a show to celebrate the 150th anniversary of Blaine. I took the whole history of the town and I squeezed it like a piece of fresh bread. I have a little announcement to make. Mort Guffman is going to come from New York City and see our show. We have one shot at this. We've got one performance. With Mort Guffman coming to town, we need to hitch up our panties and run.
Hey, lady.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm good.
Yeah.
So this week, we're talking about Waiting for Guffman.
Yeah, we are.
With Cody Ledvina.
Yes. I've been looking forward to this for ages, ever since I read that article he wrote about that grape, so...
You got a little art crush, I believe.
I did.
It's okay. That's good.
Yeah.
It's part of the ecosystem. It's like our economic system. You love me, I love you.
This is so true.
Yeah.
And so I had never seen Waiting for Guffman, but I love the director's work, and so I'm a little embarrassed that I had never checked this particular film out.
This is Betterment. This is the podcast. Yeah. It's
working.
Yeah, it's exposing us to new artists, new films.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, so I actually visited the set of Waiting for Guffman in 1995.
Way.
Yeah.
What?
So it was shot in Austin, and it was shot on the east side. And you know the scenes in the gymnasium where they're doing the play?
Yes.
Yeah, my friend Lee Hunsacker did costuming.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and I was working in film at that time, too. And so I just went to see her on, and I had known Parker Posey from another film, and you know, you just kind of go say hi.
Wow.
And also about Bob Balaban, who plays Lloyd Miller, the musical director in the play.
Yeah.
He had directed a film that I'd worked with him on like 3 years before that. So it was kind of, you know, that's the thing, like when you work in films, like you get to know actors and other technicians, and it's kind of like a family and a little drop-in. And I remember seeing, I can get into that later, but
okay.
Seeing Christopher Guest in his costume and going like, what the fuck is that? And Lee going, isn't that hilarious? And I was like,
I
can't orient. I don't know what I'm looking at. Like, is...
I want to talk to you about that for sure.
Yeah, so Waiting for Guffman came out in 1996, directed by Christopher Guest, and with an ensemble cast that he works with a lot, Eugene Levy, Parker Posey, Catherine O'Hara, Fred Willard, and it was shot in Austin, Texas, and surrounding towns for some of that small town feel. And this was, I'm not sure what order this lands in his filmography, but of course he had done Waiting for Spinal Tap. this is Spinal Tap. I think he did Best in Show afterwards.
Yeah.
But so this is, you know, this is like an improvisational ensemble cast experiment that he's really great at.
Yeah.
And so do you want to introduce the artist?
Yeah. So Cody Ledvina is a hardworking, aimless inventor equipped with resourceful guilt of taking up too much space in the world.
Aww.
He finds the most joy in using tight economy of purpose-made art materials, as well as anything found, lost, or stolen, since it gets to participate in a neat way. Some of his accomplishments are as follows. His sister just got married, so that's very like Jane Austen accomplishment.
It is.
He is a relatively new archivist at the Orange Show in Houston.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
A really important folk landmark in Houston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And from 2007 to 2013, Cody curated the Joanna, which is a space also in Houston.
Yeah.
And finally, he is able to run half a mile without a thought of stopping, which that impresses me the most. So welcome to the podcast, Cody.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Hi, Cody. So what about this fitness regime you're on? Oh,
that was a complete lie. I didn't think she would actually say that.
I knew it. I knew that
you
was...
You kind of warned us you were going to be full of bull, right?
I am totally. Yeah, yeah. It mimics the film, you know? You never know what's real.
Okay. So speaking of far out and maybe lies, mm-hmm. I was just doing a tiny little bit of research on Waiting for Guffman, and I saw that Christopher Guest was a baron. Like, he inherited a title from his British father, and he actually sat in the Lord of the House of Commons as a lord, or so I don't know how any of that stuff works, but it's like he's of the gentry. He's sure. He has like I don't know, what is that, royal? But he had an inherited title as a baron.
Yeah, it's part of that system, whatever that system may be. Yeah, I had no idea. That's interesting. I'm sure he.
I know, right?
I don't know if he embraces that, but yeah, I'm sure.
Well, yeah. Well, there was a little bit more that I read that he went and participated and like, you know, he had a vote in the House of Commons, and then he might have been a boat too. They didn't mention that, but he found the system kind of silly, while he was had that role, who's the prime minister, changed the system so that, like, his sons wouldn't be, or his children wouldn't be inheriting the title. So it just kind of stopped, and he said, but he was in agreement with that because he thought they should be elected positions rather than inherited positions. So that's where he stands on that.
Well,
interesting.
Yeah. There's quite a few people who are, you know, have quite a bit of problems with that system,
nepotism,
especially in the UK. You know, I was living over there since 2014, and the vast majority, at least people in London, are not very big
royalists.
Well, you know, they are and they aren't, but of course they understand how important it is. But I guess
it's a crushing class system.
Yeah. Well, and it's so arbitrary. I mean, it's just like, it's just so meaningless. Like, once you, you know, no responsibilities other than just being kind of these puppets in the public. And
sounds like a lot of pressure to me. You know, I would hate that pressure to go out and smile and to say the right thing all the time. I mean, I don't say the right thing ever. I don't understand how. It's such a kind of a mental discipline to be able to do that. It's kind of impressive, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
It is a performance, yeah. Mm-hmm. Speaking of performances, Cody, could you tell our listeners your history with this movie?
Hey, this is to you, Mom. No, I'm just kidding. I love her more
than
you. She's the best. Sure, yeah. So I'm pretty sure, I don't remember the first time I saw it, but I know it was when I was younger, and so
I think you did almost everything when you were younger.
Come on, man. Uh-huh. What are you doing? But I was considerably younger. I'm 37 now. I think I probably saw it when I was, I don't know, in my early teens, and I didn't really know what I was looking at. And I think it might have been, actually, you know what, it's probably later teens, because I think I was I was given the recommendation by a guy at, for listeners who are from Houston or are aware of it, there's a place called Cactus Music and Video and on West Alabama, Montrose. And you could walk up to these guys and you could rent, you know, this is a place to rent films and things like that. Independent kind of blockbuster place, you know? And I said, I'm just looking for, I'm looking for a different kind of comedy. I'm looking for something, I don't know. I didn't really know. I didn't know anything about film or anything. And he gave me, he gave me that and Troma. You know, Am I saying that right? The Toxic Avenger. Toxic Avenger.
Yeah, yeah. I think Troma was the film.
The publish house. Okay, yeah, right. Okay, Toxic Avenger. That I, that was great and all. It was cartoonish and I love that. But this one, not a Mighty Wind. That was all of his other ones. But Waiting for Guffman. I had no idea what I was looking at. I didn't. I knew it was. I knew it wasn't real. I knew it was funny, but it wasn't laugh out loud funny. It was like kind of had all of these nuances that I didn't understand. And in a weird way, it was not. I'm not. I'm going to use this word, but I don't really mean it in this way. But it was boring. And by boring, I mean only in the sense that it kind of tingled something in my brain. Meaning it wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't the thing that was, it wasn't typical of a comedy. It wasn't typical of a thing. It was it was this thing that you weren't really meant to watch. Similar to when I was a kid, I would watch the Municipal Channel would put city council meetings.
Yes.
And I knew. And then, you know, like people would get up there, they would take things from the audience or from the, and people would just go nuts, you know. And I love that. I love the idea of people just going crazy. And it was not meant to, you weren't really meant to watch that or, and that gave me the same, it gave me the same feeling. So I knew it was special. And as I got older, it just got more and more special. And it continues to, it continues like the things that, the craft, the world, the world building, the interaction, all of it is just so
Well, we're
interesting.
We're sort of in a golden age of city council freak show right now. Are you do you continue to watch these things?
Well, now that they're on YouTube, I was about to start a blog about 10 years ago called City Council, Best of City Council Fights. And now that they're everywhere, I could. I'm sure there's a subreddit for that or something. I don't know.
I'll never forget one of our radio stations here in Dallas. Just, I know it's probably the same day, same time, but every so often I'll hear the city council on the radio. And this one time, there is a hot debate about the fluoride in the water and all the theories of, contaminating our children and killing, and it was just fascinating because it
it's pre-QAnon.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a microcosm of people being really concerned about this teeny tiny little thing. And they're so vocal about it. And it was fascinating to watch, to listen to it, you know? I mean, and it just, it's sort of, it is the banal, which I think is what...
Banal. That's better. There we go.
Christopher Guest is, like, drawn to this, like, seemingly benign, you know, sort of creatures and how they can manifest in a way that is very... empathetic. I mean, I think watching this movie, it's like you feel for a lot of these people, you know.
Well, at a community level, this is the most important thing, you know. This is the most important thing that they'll do. And and look at, I feel the same way that some of the most important things that I do to an outsider's perspective are incredibly small. And those things that we participate in personally or within our community are relatively small. And, you know, even if they grow in nature, it still remains pretty small. And I think he attacks that or he attaches himself to that. And he never really allows it to get that big. And I like the scope.
there's almost like an existential dread, because they are sort of pitiable characters, and like you kind of have a you know, like your stomach hurts watching some of them be so excited about something that's just not gonna really work. Like Eugene Levy saying, like, I just realized working on this project that I am talented. And he's, you know, and they, not Cody, spoiler alert, that they all, you know, they all like, you know, move to Hollywood or go into showbiz.
Cody, could you give our listeners a brief summary of the movie in case for those who haven't seen it or maybe need a little refresher?
Of course. Yeah, it follows a small town in Missouri, essentially a 4th of July play. Celebrating its, I'm going to get it wrong, but it's basically its 150th anniversary, which I think David Guest thought would be a funny word to say because it's a... It is kind of a silly name, and there is humor in just the name itself.
Is it sesquicentennial? That's a terrible word.
and it's the authority is charged. The person who's meant to put this on is his name Corky? What's his name? I've got the guy's name.
Corky. Yeah. St. Clair.
Corky St. Clair, who is a relatively dated a gay caricature. But and that is, who is played by Christopher Guest, the guy who actually wrote and directed the film. He wrote it alongside Eugene Levy. Eugene Levy, of course, now most known for American Pie. We all know that. The father, thank you.
Oh, yeah. And Schitt's Creek.
Yeah. It's about bringing together this group of local folks from everyday life to produce produce this play about Blaine, Missouri's history. And Blaine, Missouri, I've wrote down, really is only known for two things. For a small child giving a stool to President McKinley.
A footstool.
Epically historical,
A footstool to President McKinley on a whistle stops tour. And also for a couple of people being... being abducted by UFOs, given a pot roast, and then being anally probed.
At least they got dinner.
And I love that.
Hopefully,
that
it was part after.
Of the history where it's like they thought they were on their way to California, and they sort of
they smell the salt air.
But then they just went ahead and sort of settled down. Though, obviously they weren't terribly close to the ocean. But
it's like the ancestors of the town were sort of like, good enough. It's just pervasive in the population. This'll do.
That one couple that sort of was heartbreaking,
agents.
The travel agents that had never been anywhere, and it's just
That's right. So typical. Yeah, Fred Willard and Catherine O'Hare admit that they're travel agents, but they've never been outside of Blaine.
Except for
Fred Willard to get a surgery once.
let's come back. Let's circle back to that surgery.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Because we can't peak too high too early, you know what I mean?
I can't wait to see what you've prepared.
I got a sound effect board here for you. So what happens is this play is developed. And Corky sends out letters to all over, mainly to New York, to Broadway, New York Times. I don't know who he's sending to these
theatrical critics.
Theatrical critics, exactly.
Producers.
And he does get a response. He gets a response in the mail. He gathers the cast together, and he says, "We've got a response," and a Mr. Guffman from I think it's the Times. I can't remember. Is going to come and will happily review your play. Mm-hmm. And so that then sends shockwaves through the cast. They now are convinced, at least, that they have a chance, which is very true. I mean, the letter does seem real. Even I'm not. There's no spoilers, but it does. Mm-hmm. At the end, they never disprove it. And so they think, well, we got to try extra hard now. We can't just do this for the citizens of Blaine. We've got to do this for possibly taking this exact show that we're going to do onto Broadway. And then the show happens. And I will say, I made a mark, a timestamp here. It looks like about half of the way, a little more than half of the way through, it turns into a full-on musical. So for any of you who like that, and I do, all the songs are incredibly catchy. Mm-hmm. They do.
They're good, right?
They are really good. They're ridiculous. They're silly, and you know they're acted poorly and sung incredibly poorly. But they are catchy, and then. The meeting with the critic happens at the end, and I don't know how much further we want to go with that, but
I think you can spoil it. We're going to probably go enough. Into it.
Okay, so if you don't want to, maybe cut it off here.
We encourage people to see the film before they listen to the podcast, just so they know what the hell we're talking about.
Okay, well, in that case, then y'all know what I'm talking about already. Okay, well, then, of course, they find out that the person seated in the seat that was meant for the Times reporter or critic was, in fact, just a guy there to see his kid. Or, no, he wasn't even. He was there to visit. He was visiting his nephew. And
He got a balloon or something. Oh my god.
He's just a random out of towner who didn't have anything to do that night. Came to the performance. Yeah.
And I will say, he is that guy. That weird, very tall man is in almost all of Christopher Guest films in a
really?
Very, very small way. Yeah, he was in Spinal Tap. He was in he was in A Mighty Wind. I don't know if he was in Best in Show, but
Best in Show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Now I know that actor from the Bob Newhart show.
Oh yes.
Oh my god.
He was a regular. I think he was a neighbor.
That's right.
Maybe a pilot.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh man, you just set me back there.
Tall and deep voice, yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And he might be British or Australian, right?
I think he just has a weird, like a weird American.
That transatlantic acting voice. Mm-hmm.
I think he was on the Addams Family movie as the neighbor. Damn you, Addams! Kind of. So one of my favorite characters in that movie. So they're distraught. And of course, in the typical, you know, Christopher Guest movie, we get, what is it, 3 months later or 6 months later?
And everything is either the exact same or incredibly different.
Or even worse, I think. I don't know. I mean,
And, you know, I was going to say, as an artist, as someone that's like, you know, when you're given just the little tiniest glimmer of hope that your career might take off, and you let yourself run away with that fantasy, watching these actors go from like, I'll come to your play, to the director delivering the letter with, guess what? We're going to Broadway. we're like skipping 17 essential steps.
All right.
But you know, you kind of get it. You know, like you're so excitable. You know, you're so optimistic. Or you wouldn't be doing these damn things for free. Mm-hmm. You know, going to rehearsals. You know, putting all your extra time into this.
No, the older I get, the more I relate in a way. You know, the more I kind of have empathy for these people. There was time you would kind of laugh at them, and of course you still do because it is a bit ridiculous.
Yeah.
But
it is really funny. Yeah.
But also I think the actors, all of them, are tapping into that part of themselves that puts themselves out there and know how bad it is or how difficult it is to do that and to face that kind of rejection and to make bad art. I mean, look, I don't think that any of them, you know, they've all made bad stuff and they know it and or maybe they didn't know it. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, and you know, too, talking about the quality of the stage performances and the play within the movie. Like, the acting is so over the top, so bad. And that's when I get belly laughs. It's like, I love terrible acting. Uh-huh. Like, that is just one of my sweet spots. Like, that's why I love John Waters, too.
Uh-huh.
You know, like the worse it is,
I was telling my students the other day about, like, early, like, American, like, sort of European art. And how poorly it was done, but I sort of love it because it's so awkward and it's not refined in any, it's not elegant, but it's like, it's funky and it's, I feel the same way. Yeah.
I'm picturing like a portrait of a little girl holding a hat. Yes. And nothing is working and the stairs are off and like, but you know, actually, so I used to really hate early American art, and it creeped me out.
Oh, it's creepy, yeah.
But Robert Hughes, who was an art critic, who's deceased, wrote a book called American Visions about art history. Mm. And it's he lines it up with like popular history. Mm. And it's a really great book, and it's not dense, because I can't take dense reading. Mm-hmm. But it's... it gave me an appreciation for early American art.
Oh, I'm gonna have to look into that.
Yeah, American Visions.
All right. So this movie reminded me of, I don't know what to call it. It could be considered a sculpture. It is located in, it's a found sculpture, if that's a thing, I suppose. But it... my parents, they live in a teeny tiny village in Portugal, and it sort of sets it up, you know, with this like small town kind of, you know, everybody knows each other and they're, you know, they get into the juicy gossip very easily anyway. And you follow this path down by the river and there's this large rock and it does look just like a potato. And that's like, it's a thing there. It's like a little, the potato rock, and everybody's got to go check it out because it does, it's convincing. And there's something I just, you know, like, and sometimes maybe you might, you know, get your picture taken next to it, and it's like a little landmark. And I love that. Like, it just brings me so much joy to know that that exists in the world, you know? And that happens like all around the country. If you go to these small towns, it's like, we've got the biggest ball of yarn and we've got the, you know, I mean, it's just, it's wild, you know, these sort of like small town.
I lived in Tulsa, Oklahoma for 2 years, and there's something called the Center of the Universe. And what a grand title, right? Like, what are you kind of expecting you might see? Well, what it is, it's some fucking like knee height concrete benches in a circle that have like an echo.
That's cool. Oh my gosh.
And so you stand in the center and you clap and it echoes toward you. And they decided to call that Center of the Universe.
I mean, why not?
Yeah.
I mean, it's great. I love calling things and just saying that. I did all of these projects where I just proclaimed that I solved photosynthesis. And the idea is completely insane and doesn't mean anything, but it's now that now I've said that, and now that exists in the world. The Center of the Universe exists in Tulsa, Oklahoma, because they said so. I mean, I quite like that. I, you know, just make a claim and just move on.
Go with it.
That seems very American.
Right? Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Like a very stable genius.
So Cody, I was looking on your website and you have a little ditty about some family law, and it sort of reminds me a little bit of this movie where, you know, you don't know how it's not serious. It's sort of satirical, I suppose, but can you tell us a little bit about like where this came from? And
yeah,
I didn't read it all, but it's,
I mean, it's you're not
quite...
meant to, it's, you're meant to.
Okay.
It.
It's good, yeah.
Yeah, it's
Is it meant to exhaust you?
Kind of. I mean, it's really, so I like to take on projects in which I have no idea, you know, nothing about, and that, but I just simply exclaim that I am an expert. So whether that be in science or in this case law, I wrote the world's first. I also like to be the first at things. So the world's first document that explains if it's family law for aliens, and if humans met, when humans meet aliens, we're gonna fuck one of them. You know what I mean? We're gonna come on.
Oh yeah.
We're gonna and it's somehow if it's not the first one, it'll be the second or the third, which we'll be able to impregnate either one way or another, and it'll work because we're essentially all made of the same shit. So yes. Eventually that'll happen.
Yeah. Now,
what happens when that, you know, you give birth to this half human, half alien thing, and now, you know, we're probably not going to create a bunch of accords by that point, or treaties, or this is early days. So I'm producing the legal framework for what happens when we get, and they get horny enough to, you know, to copulate to, is that the right?
But it's an eventuality.
Yeah. Do you mean when they get desperate enough to have sex with
us? No way. People think, we're going to meet aliens and we're going to try and communicate and do this. No. Just like anything, the first thing we're going to try and do is either destroy them, which is fine, I suppose, or they us. Mm-hmm. And the second will be, let's see if I can stick my dick in this thing.
Right. Show me your holes.
Exactly. Or the other way around. You know, whatever it is. Yeah. Or someone will be willing to try it. And that's probably the best form of diplomacy at that point, to be honest. And
absolutely.
Reminds me of like a phase that infants go through where they try to identify the world in different tactile stages. Then they go through an oral phase where everything goes in their mouths, like a foot. Yeah.
That's the premise. That's the premise of this, is that we are simply just trying to discover as human beings this new thing. And I think, a lot of the films that are beautiful films, Contact, Arrival, all of these things, which kind of delve into the really gorgeous idea of the metaphysical and the deepness of those kind of connections, really, I think ultimately it might just come down to this act. And let's say it results in a child, then I've written the document that dictates what happens if those two parties decide not to raise the child by themselves. Together. So it's essentially
a
divorce contract. Yeah, it's what happens. So I've laid that all out. And it's got to be there because someone has to write this. Okay, someone has to be there to write this. And I know I'm doing the dirty work. Yes. Okay. Am I mad? Do I feel underappreciated? Yes. I need this to happen, and I think it needs to go on the books, and people need to be able to have this there. And now this is, of course, going to happen hundreds and hundreds of years from now, but at least I can say
I do love the idea of you, Cody, on a billboard practicing family extraterrestrial law practice, and you've got your arms crossed and you're wearing a cheap suit and you're saying, you know, like, did your alien baby daddy leave you?
Yeah.
Paternity testing.
I think at one point I...
Visitation.
I proposed a prison planet or some. I don't know. I mean, and I have what do you call the things in lines that have numbers separated by symbols? Whatever those are.
Columns?
No. The thing where it's x plus 4 minus 2, you know, whatever that's called.
A formula?
Formula. I got a bunch of formulas for this shit.
I feel like this is like the start of a joke.
I'm thinking this is like some uber technical term that I'm like, there's no way I would even know.
I just couldn't remember it. I genuinely could not remember the term.
How many artists does it take to to find a word in common?
Good thing
usage.
I'm not an actual lawyer. Boy, oh boy.
Yeah.
Not
I don't know.
Yet.
I've met several. I think you could probably, you know.
Yeah, I could finagle something.
Right there with them.
Speaking of first, Cody, like, you could start a law school.
Mm.
Like, who better to teach than the person that, you know, started the whole thing?
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, thanks for feeding the ego, man.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we do with each other,
true,
isn't it?
True, it is. It is true.
Nobody
is
else true. Is listening.
Yeah, that's true. It's an echo chamber.
That's not true.
Hey, Aaron, this week we got 3 listens.
Yeah, we
you,
did.
Me, and Cody.
I don't mean to scare you, but, like, we get a lot of more listens than 3. So there are...
Okay.
They might be extraterrestrial. I don't know. They're coming from all over the place.
Well, they had a Google alert. All the slutty aliens had a Google alert. And they're listening for their...
You know what I think got me on slutty aliens? Do you remember...
Speaking of...
What was Arnold Schwarzenegger, the lady with the 3 boobs?
Oh, is that Terminator?
Total Recall.
Total Recall.
Oh, my God. Wait, that's a thing? Oh, my God.
Oh, it's fantastic. Saw that early on. That might have actually been my first boob because internet. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, she wears like a prosthetic breastplate, right? That has 3.
Yeah. It's comically ridiculous. I rewatched it. I was like, that's hilarious. But yeah.
Oh, wow.
Do they move? Are they...
I don't think so. I think they're
convincing.
I think they're just at a bar or something. She's like, "You want to see something?" He said, "All right." And it was totally didn't need to be in the film.
She needs to find her perfect mate, somebody with 3 testicles, and it's a match made in heaven.
Or 15 fingers.
That too.
adding, okay. Anyway, formula. There's a formula for that somewhere.
So, have you been in a play or a production?
I have not. No, no.
Never.
No, I find that so terrifying. And I was actually even thinking about when they were in the back room,
backstage.
And the lady.
We thesbians refer to that as backstage.
When the lady comes in and she says, "Hey, everyone, things are you're about to go on. Good luck, break a leg."
Yeah, yeah.
And in that moment when she said that, "Break a leg, go out and have good," I had such a sense of dread. I was right there with them. I was like, I was terrified to go out even in front of this Blaine crowd, you know, and perform in front of them. Even that was just so intimidating. And so I really do think, like, yes, it's funny. It is funny. It is super silly, this play that they put on.
Yeah.
But it does take quite a bit of courage for these fictional characters, of course.
Oh, yeah.
To go out onto. And it also, I also realized something about this, about the development of this. As you see it, there are a lot of craftsmen in the background, you know, painting sets, doing this, the
musicians.
Orchestra, the musicians, you know, and all of them pulled it off. And the only lackluster folks are the actors.
in the spotlight, it's true.
You know, again, like I said, as the older I get, the more I'm like, oh, I see the background. I see how long that probably took somebody who wasn't getting paid, who wasn't doing that, you know, who had to do this or that. Yeah.
So never as a child, Cody, you never have been forced to. Okay.
Once.
Well, what was it?
I was 5, and a kid. It was something as 3 blind mice, and a kid did not want to go down a little slide dressed as a mouse. And he totally got spooked about it, and I was like, I'll do that. And I went up, and my mom could not have been more proud. I mean, I think she still talks about it to this day. It was adorable, I will say. I mean, obviously not at the time. I wasn't like, oh, look at me. But now I think back at that, I was like, you know, and she loved that idea.
Saved
the show. But since then, no, I have crippling anxiety about that idea.
Mm-hmm. Hyde, have you ever been in a production when you were a kid or anything?
Yeah, sure. School plays. But like nothing good, nothing I could remember. And then, you know, like just being on the peripheral of like I worked in theater and film for a long time. And so, no, I was never, and you know, also artist and like somebody might need help with a performance or just a warm body, basically, you know, and like I would often get cast in friends' films for like not demanding parts, but you know, just really like they say meat puppets, you know, push them through the scenery.
Sorry. So hi, you said you knew Parker Posey from a previous, how did you know her previously?
Yeah, I had worked, so I guess Waiting for Guffman was shot in 95, and I think it was 91 that I had worked on Dazed and Confused, the Rick Linkletter film, and Parker was in that, and a lot of huge actors now, like Matthew McConaughey, I think that was his first film.
Yeah, before all of his...
Mila Jovovich,
Doesn't he do, like, tequila commercials or whatever else he's on?
He does fucking everything. He is a cash cow.
He's selling the sex toys at Target we talked about. I don't know, but...
No, I don't think he has that endorsement
in the future. I wouldn't be surprised.
My favorite are those Lincoln commercials when he's hyper serious about absolutely nothing and nothing makes sense. Fantastic, those.
Yeah. Just like syrup.
Okay,
yeah.
I love Parker Posey, and I was first introduced to her from a movie. Let me click on her bio really quickly.
Is it House of Yes?
No, it was Clock.
Clock Watchers. Mm-hmm.
I saw it in high school, and I was like, "Is this gonna be my future? I'm gonna be a 10."
Talk about dismal. Yeah.
Can you explain that one quickly to?
Oh yeah.
What's the premise?
Toni Collette's in that too.
Toni. Beautiful cast, and basically, it's this ragtag group of female temp workers at this. It's very kind of has, if you like Office Space, like that's gonna be your jam. But it kind of gets a little dark because they form a tight bond, but then somebody gets accused of stealing. And the whole time, like, they're totally, like, giving the middle finger to the company because they're just like, this is such bullshit. Like, we're not a part of anything. So accusations are kind of being tossed around. And then they end up, like, not being friends at the end. And it really sucks to watch. But I just thought, gosh, she's so cool. Like, she was such a cool actor, you know, in the 90s. So and it's always...
A particular bond with work friends, isn't there? You know, for them to make it work.
It's gossip. It's drinks after work. I mean, you are
maybe not
like
so much anymore, but that was the one benefit of that hardcore 9-to-5 kind of thing or whatever hours you were working. That camaraderie that you would take back to the bar, pub, or
I talked to a friend of mine today who I worked with in the early 90s, dressing mannequins in a department store. So I've known her like over 30 years, and we just did some catching up today. So yeah, like work friendships can be incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can only imagine what happens whenever to kind of bring it back to the. To the film, I was thinking in my they never really address this, but the friendship that happens amongst these guys on set, or well, not in real life, but like on their the fake stage thing, you know, the dentist, they're all like kind of doing this thing, and they're on top of the world, and they, you know, they're going through this thing, and they have this special bond, and I was thinking about like what they, you know, and Parker Posey in this film, I think she plays a teenager. But she's vibing and kind of having a total bond with these adults, and it's a very strange moment. Mm-hmm. And of course, Corky,
we got to dig into Corky.
He's the professional. Yeah.
God, Corky does have a bit of a has a bit of a predatory vibe towards one of the main leads, who is the whose son, who his father is played by.
Who is that actor?
Phil. It's what's his name? It's It's not.
He does such a great job of giving Corky the hairy eyeball when he comes to the garage to to cast his son in the film.
I'm getting him confused. You know who I'm getting him confused with? Is Ola? Is What About Bob?
With Arquette?
I'm getting him confused with Ola. All the Wes Anderson films. The guy who pours drinks. You know,
that guy.
Come on, what are we doing?
Shoot.
Bill Murray. Jesus Christ.
Yes. It's not Bill Murray.
Yeah, Bill Murray's not in Waiting for
Godot. Looks like him.
He could have been. I think he would have been a natural. But
anyway.
Yeah. So Corky. Can we talk about Corky? Because my favorite scene in this whole movie is when he's like dancing or thrusting. I'm not exactly sure which. And he's got like these jeans like backwards.
Yeah, right. That was like the time of what, Crisscross. Do you remember that?
Yes.
That musical group, and they wore their clothes backwards. And I think Corky's like trying to, we call like, adopt a trend, you know. He's just not doing well.
But I think in 1995 or 96, whenever it was filmed, that was already outdated. So I think it was a kind of, if you really think about the timing of it, it was kind of an outdated
thing. Yeah, it was a joke already.
A joke,
I mean, it still hits well. I mean, like, I was in stitches.
Oh my God, yeah. Go ahead.
So, I mean, he's so, like, bad at it, but, I mean, so, Hyde, what are your thoughts on Corky? Like, is he...
Well, okay, so my ex, Johnny, used to, like, tease me about being like Corky Sinclair.
No.
He said, he's like, especially when you get mad, and when he's like, you're all bastard people. Are you like, you ass face, you know? Like, I think... Johnny would see me in moments where that I'm not proud of, where I was probably like cursing and, you know, having some strong reaction to in a work situation. But you know, it's funny because I'm watching Corky Sinclair and I'm like, is this okay to laugh at? Because I'm a little, it's kind of like gay face. It's like blackface, but like gay. But you know, I also look at it and I was like, is it horrible? Is he doing it with affection?
Right.
You know, because I'm queer as like anything you've ever met, and I'm laughing at it because he's very good at finding these little nuances of like expression, or like when he's on stage and he's walking with Parker Posey, and he's like, He's doing this little stroll thing where he's pointing his toe out, and it's just so funny.
Well, it's because remember he had to take the place of the very masculine lead, everything about is him coming back from World War I or whatever, and talking about how, you know, how masculine he is, and how these, you know, it did not age well in that way, but it doesn't. It doesn't feel too,
you know,
too aggressive.
And it is interesting too to like look at a queer character in a Midwestern town, like trying to pursue something in the arts, and how he's got fans. Mostly people in the town are just like, that Corky's a genius.
Yeah.
And the only time he gets pushback is from the actor's father, who he kind of realizes, like, is this a casting couch thing? What's this queer doing in my garage?
Right.
But that's the only example of, like, Corky having to deal with, like, something negative and homophobic.
Wait, Hyde, you're homophobic, yeah, but you're forgetting when he gets laughed at when he proposes $100,000.
Yes, but that's not because he's queer. That's just because he's bad with money.
That's ridiculous. And haven't we all been there when we're like, if only I had $100,000, you know,
right,
to really make something of. And it's only after he knew that the critic was coming and it's like,
right,
a lot was on the line. But isn't that wonderful how we, like, I thought was really great that he actually pulled off a pretty, like, remarkable set and production on a shoestring budget.
Yeah. And we could talk about, like, the real cost of producing art, too, because so many times we've all experienced this, like, oh, this is fun for you, so you're going to do this for free, and you're going to go find all the materials. And it's like the real cost of putting on a stage production, it wouldn't be $100,000, but I did see the budget for Waiting for Guffman was $4 million.
Oh.
Which is kind of relatively small. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and I wonder, I mean, I haven't really looked into the process of how they did that, but you know, the format is ad lib within a framework. So I wonder how many takes it, you know, and it looks like it was on film. It wasn't digital. I mean, it's, you know, relatively expensive in terms of its, like the physical material to produce it. And the art direction looked cool. Like a lot of my favorite bit is parts are where they cut away and they make a reference to something and they cut away to like a clearly Photoshopped version of something. You know, my father was, you know, Eugene Levy said, I got the acting bug because my father and grandfather was on vaudeville and there was this ridiculous, probably Christopher Guest dressed up in a vaudeville. It was ridiculous, but those kind of things, you know, those art direction, the art department's application of these elements, you know, that takes time. It takes a lot of another one, real quick one that really disgusted me was, I don't know if y'all saw this or remember, but Corky's talking and he's laying out the plans for the thing to the play to the film crew, and the film crew
poor
pans. Puppy. It starts with an ashtray of about 20, half, not even half, like three quarters smoked cigarettes, and next to that is a tray full of unbaked pigs in the blanket. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen something more disgusting in my life. I mean, the visceral, like all of that together, just was so nauseating. And, I mean, I know it was their joke, but and I know that doesn't cost a lot of money, but anyway, these kind of accumulations.
Well, it's thoughtful, and it's like, it's not to you know, like I think about films in the 40s where they're all trying to stoke like envy, you know, where it's like, oh, look at this fabulous life. It's sort of like pre-Kardashian, like, oh, look at all the things that we have and how, you know, don't you wish you could live like this? And then Christopher Guest is having fun with, like, isn't this gross and sad?
It's awful. So gross.
And that production designer, I noticed it was John Frick, who is like a longtime Austin production designer. And I worked with him on Dazed and Confused.
Oh, cool. That's so cool. So
really nice guy.
And we can talk a little bit, Aaron, I know that we were talking about I had to end up looking it up. And it is, in fact, Lockhart. So although just outside of Austin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're the barbecue capital.
The towns, the town square. Where, like, kind of the early I think the travel agent was also Lockhart and Corky's and Corky's apartment, which we should talk about how amazing that apartment is. Holy moly,
that bathroom, like the tub and the bubbles.
Oh my god. I'd love to be in that downtown Lockhart in a giant pink open plan apartment. Yes, please.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to forget to talk about Corky's hair. And then, like, what made me think of it is when he's in that scene when he's in the bathtub, when he's sort of like nursing his wounds after he won't get $100,000 from the city council, and he's taking a bubble bath, and he's got like a shower cap on in the tub, which is really funny, but his bangs aren't there, and I was like, so is it a toupee? I mean, we know it's a toupee, but does he know it's a toupee?
What's wild is that this is going to sound nuts, but okay, so I had seen, my history with this movie is that I had seen Best in Show, which is one of my favorite comedies of all time. And I didn't know that Christopher Guest was the character in that movie. I didn't know that he was the director. So didn't know that. But then it was only until the very end that I made the connection that Corky is also the
guy with the hound dog.
The guy with the hound dog. I was like, oh my God, I didn't even recognize him. It was just such a different character. So, but it was, I think, the hair, and it's just like, it's like this weird.
And his manner, you know?
Yeah. Oh, totally different. Totally different. So such a great, range that he has with acting. The hair is like, it's this weird mushroomy looking thing sitting on his head that
that haircut is Rand Paul. That's the only other person I know who has that haircut.
You're right.
It's pretty classic. So.
I mean, it's a bit curly, but it's the same thing. Yeah. It just sits there like a disc.
Yeah.
But what is it? It's kind of juvenile for an adult to have bangs, adult man to have bangs, right?
Yeah, I feel like he's combining like a sort of 90s cut, like the bowl cut that kids used to get with like a la Devon Sawa or whatever, with like something else. Like there's two haircuts merged together.
Yeah. Oh, it's the Missouri Compromise.
Oh, nice one. Well done. Good job, well done, man. I'm gonna write that down.
I kind of stole that because that's a mullet is sometimes referred to as a Missouri Compromise or a Kentucky Waterfall or you know.
They're so classy, you know. I'm not. Yeah, I mean, I swoon with that haircut. So,
can we talk a little bit about the music?
Yes.
Oh yes.
What did you did? I don't know if you. It's, I mean, I don't want to put you on the
so
spot.
Good.
But
Penny
do you have
for
a favorite
your thoughts.
Song?
Can't get it out of my mind. Yeah. It's also the dancing part, as Hyde mentioned. When my like the other one of my favorite parts
pointing
is
pointing the toe.
But the
like
at the very end when Parker Posey is like taking this little ballerina pose,
she goes
and then
all the way.
Corky also takes this little ballerina. It's such a lovely song. Like, it's kind of this really little, and you're not expecting it because the whole thing's so silly.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's for the listeners who haven't seen this, it's this sort of love song about a soldier going off to war and, you know, the French girls and.
Oh, you should insert it.
Oh, I will. I will.
You
do
should
that.
Play a little bit of it right here.
Yes.
But it is, I don't know if it's minor key or what, but it like, it kind of, it tugs a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like I found myself getting a tear.
I know, it hits you. And I don't want to keep, you know, plugging Christopher Guest, but if you do, if you are into these kinds of things, A Mighty Wind also will make you, will get you there. It's really, really quite impressive. The music. I don't know who, I actually should have looked that up, but I don't know if he did that or who's done those, but they're really, really amazing.
He definitely had a hand in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The stool one is so stupid because it's meant to kind of be this Bauhaus. I don't know what it's meant to be, but it's a very, very.
Working. What is it like? Yeah. It's like, working. Yeah. Do it. Yeah, it's like industrialization.
Yeah. And they're so. I think the thing that defines this whole film is being too earnest, you put it all on the line. You know, you put it all on the line, and you put every movement is just so fantastic. There's the smallest of movements, even with Catherine O'Hara, and when she's when she's.
She's a genius.
Physically, she is so good in this film.
Mm-hmm.
When she's auditioning with Fred Willard, who's also good, but he's more of a kind of a one-liner guy, but or a multi-liner guy, to be honest. He strings them along. But she she has this vulnerability. I know this is like dissecting it on such a level because I've seen this so many times, but I love it.
It's
she's kind of on her tiptoes, and you can tell that she's like walking on eggshells. Like she doesn't want to bother anybody. She wants to be not subservient, but she wants to make certain that she is getting everything right. Mm-hmm. And,
yes.
And she's not fully
she's
coming down.
She's a diligent contributor.
Always. Yeah. And every single film that she's in with Christopher Guest, she plays the same role. Mm-hmm. I will not say, like, she plays the same kind of, do you all have a better way of describing this? Like, a wife that's not, like, kind of.
She's supportive. She's. Yeah.
But she's also got her own, like, vision or personality, except for the end when, like, her husband, you know, Fred Willard is like kind of like directing her, and then she puts on this weird fake smile. The end is a little jarring to me. Before we get into the ending, though, I did want to share with you all that I had a Catherine O'Hara moment in fifth grade. All right. I'm going to impress you all. Fifth grade actor. So there was a Christmas play, and I think second, third, fourth graders, we all sang in the play, but when you were older, you got to actually get a part. So you kind of look forward to this like for 4 years, you know, when you're like, what am I going to be?
Yeah.
And in my little wormy brain as, you know, 11-year-old or something, when we were auditioning, they gave the part like of an elf to audition with. And I was like, I'm going to show them that this role is so beneath me that I'm going to do a really bad job. That's where my head was at. Anyway.
Oh, interesting.
So that's what, okay, I don't know why I thought that, but that's
what
I was thinking.
Wow, that's you're playing the long game.
I did.
It's cool.
So if you can imagine, I didn't get a great part in the play. I was very disappointed because, ironically, I was the elf with no part, no speaking line. And I was like, God damn it. So, but I thought, you know, I'm going to like really do my best here. And I was just being all elfy. And I remember every day that we worked on this, I would go up to the teacher and I said, do I get something to say? And she was like, we're working on it. And never. And so I performed my little elf heart out, but honestly, I just thought I was doing what everybody else was doing. You know, I just thought we were all doing the same thing.
Right.
And then it was only years later that my parents told me that I like stole the show as the non.
Oh.
I know. I like evidently I was so animated that everybody was looking at me and wasn't paying attention to everybody else.
What was required of
I
you?
Know. I don't even remember. I was like packaging up Christmas presents, like mime sort of style, and I was like really into
it. You know what that's called, right, Erin?
I don't.
Chewing up the scenery.
Oh my god, that's it.
When you're just like. But good for you.
But here's okay. So I had my 3 months later moment after that because my parents enrolled me in like an acting class.
Oh no!
Because of it, and I didn't really care about acting. Like I just wanted to be in this play. I wanted to have a part in this play. And then of course I get cast as like a rat, and I'm like, I hate acting. Like this is the worst. Like, get me out of here. The kids are so weird. I mean.
Yeah. I really want to work on your acting resume now that you've been like an elf and a rat. And like.
My poor parents are like, what is up with our child? So it didn't work out in the end.
You know, I have a great alien family lawyer who also does entertainment contracts. And maybe he can. work with you on your next. Oh, he's here. He's on the call.
Hey, how are you?
Yes. I need assistance.
Well, I deal exclusively in DUIs.
Got it.
I can't do the acronym right now.
I'm going to need some pro bono or something on this. There have been some criticism with Christopher Guest's oeuvre.
I can imagine.
What are you imagining exactly?
I don't know. I would. The first thing I would say, because I watch it maybe once every 2 years or something, about that, and I rewatched it this week, and I was like, woof. His character, especially as Corky, is a lot.
Yeah.
It is a bit. And
It's a very different experience, isn't it? Like watching a film knowing that you're going to be publicly speaking about it.
Yes, it absolutely like is. Somehow defend it, but you know, on this podcast, the premise is, what's a film that has kind of that you like and or that has contributed in some way or that has a parallel to your art making? Or something like that. So, and my art making is primarily kind of to caricaturize gay people. No, it's not.
I'm like, wait a minute, what did I miss?
Not at all. So when I saw that, it was like really kind of like, I don't know if I need that. I don't want to attach myself to that.
Interesting.
Or real. But I also don't think it's. Like I'd said earlier, I don't know if it's targeted and
It doesn't feel malicious, I don't think.
Yeah.
Then again,
I mean, who am I to say? As a straight guy, you know, I don't know.
Right.
So I don't really make that call. But anyway.
Well, so that is maybe part of some of the criticism that I was reading, but he tends to feel perhaps that he's sort of punching down at times on the sort of, you know, these big dreams that people have. And it's really like only in the 3 months, 6 months, whatever, at the end that I think that this happens, because up to that point, all of the characters are sort of coddled and they're sort of dealt with in a loving, kind way, even though they're comical, but they're sincere. And I think that we can empathize with their journey, because 99.9% of the people on this planet have had dreams and maybe have not worked out the way that they thought. I mean, I thought I was going to be a great elf at one point.
But you're right, Erin. They're all doubling down on their bet of like, I'm going to be a performer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of sad, because we as an audience, I think, are recognizing that this is like, this person doesn't have great instincts or huge talent. But in the meantime, they're kind of enjoying what they're doing.
They are. They're having... And they are, in a way, successful. You know, with this movie, it's like the play is a success. Everybody is enjoying it, and they are raving. And it's a celebration. The title, of course, is terrible, Red, White, and Blaine. But other than that, it is mwah. You know, it is great. However, the end, it is... They are left with... their future ambitions, and it doesn't go well for any of them.
You know what it is too? I feel like if they had not been waiting for Guffman, if they had not had the expectation that they were going to get discovered and go to New York, they would have just enjoyed being in the play and entertaining their community. And what it was, it's like the Buddhist thing. What fucked them up is that they had the expectation of something grander, so they couldn't just be in the moment.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, it's really sucky, because at the end of the play, they're thrilled. I mean, they're just like, they're on a high, you know, as you can imagine. And then they find out that, of course, Guffman isn't Guffman. And then they're just devastated. It's like they just go from the highest high to the lowest low, and nothing changed. You know, their performances were exactly the same. But, you know, then so Parker Posey is still working. She's working at a different Dairy Queen.
Yeah.
Eugene Levy is performing in front of a bunch of older folks who are disengaged.
Yeah, he's performing at an old folks home. Yeah, at a nursing home.
I mean, are they being punished, you know, for their...
I don't think so. Like, I think every single one of them are having a great time. Fred Willard and Catherine O'Hara are out in L.A. exactly where they wanted to be. That was their big... That was their dream. That was their goal. They are extras, and they're getting yelled at. But, you know, ultimately, I don't think... I take the opposite approach. I think that Parker Posey was an ambivalent teenager the whole time, and she still is.
Yeah.
You know, and she'll grow out of that eventually, I suppose. But
yeah, her brain chemistry is still settling.
I mean, she might have become famous with her non-fat, you know, ice cream concoction.
You know,
you never
know. I was wondering if they were referencing Anna Nicole Smith. And I would have to look at timelines.
That's
but Anna Nicole Smith worked in a dairy.
That's right, she did.
In Texas. I want to say like in Garland or something, right?
Very classy, yes.
Yeah. So they could have been picking up on something like that.
Interesting.
You know?
I mean.
Yeah, and for the, and I'm not defending the guy. I don't know what his what he was after or how he developed the film. Or these characters, but you know, he does a lot of these things that are based in show business, even if it's even if it's a really small
like a dog show,
putting on, you know, I think I forgot he did one that was also really good that no one ever saw called Thanksgiving at Purim and Thanksgiving. Or
It was called For Your Consideration.
For Your Consideration, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh.
And
the film within the film was, was something for Purim.
Thanksgiving at Purim, For Your Consideration, which was about the idea that they would win an Oscar. And how, you know, that. So it all seems to kind of revolve around this performance
recognition
for your performance and getting it or not getting it in one way or another and being and I'm certain within that framework he was able to kind of and punch down definitely Jesus Christ some of these stereotypes are insane but it's his world that, and I'm certain that he deals with the same thing as many artists do. You know, we produce something, and we share it, and then we're exposed to this criticism or this whatever it is, vulnerability, whatever it may be. And he's kind of
exposed. You know, Christopher Guest might have a lot more in common with these sort of like sad characters than we realize, because from our perspective, he's this prolific filmmaker who's beloved, but you know, he's married to Jamie Lee Curtis, whose parents or his, you know, Christopher Guest's in-laws are Hollywood royalty.
Yeah.
And like, he's, from their perspective, he's fucking around with these kind of like little experiments, these little $4 million pictures, you know? And so he's, in his world, he's probably like the saddest underdog
the outsider.
He knows.
Yeah. That's so interesting.
But it always is a little bit, not disappointing or sad, but how they just return to reality. You want to see them go and make the big time, but they always just return to reality, you know, and that's always,
I mean, it's a lot more believable they don't have careers because they
never did.
You know, what's interesting is that just coincidentally, I came across a video, about this artist. This is a bummer, so you've been warned, but there's some guy who was cleaning out some shed, dumpster, warehouse thingy, and he came across like this monumental body of work, like sculptures and paintings, and unknown, like they didn't know who made them. And so, of course, you know, there's a quest to discover who the artist was. And it was some fellow from the 1980s who had like a fairly prolific career. Like he did some public work in New York City, which you're like, that's a big coup for anybody. And then he just kind of like made work but didn't show it, and then it just all ended up in this dumpster. And it's just like, oh, like, is that where we all go? Like,
Aaron, I feel like you just told my story.
Oh, no.
Come on.
Without the Public Art Commission.
Not the New York City Public Art. Okay.
And I don't think it's very nice of you.
I'm sorry. It really it bummed me out because, I mean, right now I'm sort of contending with, like, what to do with artwork in a move. And it's like, does it just get thrown away? Like, what happens to it? And I think that's kind of what happens to a lot of us. Like, we just end up in dumpsters, and it kind of sucks. I don't know what to do with that. I don't know how to feel about it. I haven't processed it.
Well, I think the only solution is to create an artist cemetery. So, or like artwork cemetery. You go, you put it there. People can come and visit it. I guess they can take things. I don't know.
They could take it. Yeah, sure, why not?
Okay. Like, Cody, you can get some of your alien friends who built the pyramids a long time ago to build a big hollow pyramid for us to store our art and our ashes in.
Yeah. I got a kid named Zebulon who will be able to sort that out. He's 1,000 years old already.
Oh, my goodness.
Time traveler. He's done this. He's done this 100 times.
Hilarious. Zebulon.
Go ahead, Hi. I wanted to ask Cody, so I've watched some of your films on glass tire platforms and all, and I totally got why you chose Guffman, you know, because, like, it's a spoof, and I feel like you're spoofing. Mm-hmm. That's your sensibility.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was going to ask you what's coming up that you're excited about. Any shows, any projects?
I don't know when this releases, but on May 14th.
It's May 3rd today, right?
This will be releasing on, what is it? It's next Monday.
Great. So that'll do.
Yeah,
so
good timing. Yeah.
Fantastic. So anyone in Houston who wants to see some of my drawings, paintings, will be up at Jay Wainert's. Oh no, I should pull this up. Intuitive Eye Annex, which is, and that's May 14th on the it's from 4 to 7, and it is at 731 Rutland Street, Houston, in the Heights. It's, I don't know if y'all know Jay Wainert, but he is fantastic, has a massive collection of self-taught folk outsider arts.
So
that,
he's a private collector?
He's a private collector, yeah, but he has this space next to his house. Another house, which he's just renovated.
Okay.
And before they kind of move into that, I'm going to put some things up there. It's only for that weekend, maybe for a week. So come have a look, because it's not going to be up for too long. And that's kind of the way I like to show these things for now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of a private, the work I make is very personal, in that it's just things that I latch on to. It's not something it's not a universal truth. I'm not saying anything ultimately, but it is an exploration of something that I'm interested in, whether it be, who knows. And so putting them up in a kind of a domestic setting to me is a little bit more interesting.
Yeah.
Totally.
That sounds like really nice and intimate, but I wanted to tell you that I actually have a letter here that says a curator from the MoMA will be visiting. His name is Schwartz, I believe.
Okay.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Well, so if you need to wait for Mr. Schwartz to come by.
So if you're listening to this, I'm going to need a lot more money to put this on. And I think you know
at least 100. 2 maybe.
Okay, he's on the other line. He just said no.
Well, do you think, by the way, I have to ask. You bastard people. Do you think that that was off the cuff, or like, do you think he really thought of it? Because the funniest, because he pauses. And you could see that he's searching for something. And when he says that, it is the most hilarious explosion of a non-threatening thing.
Like, people that can't curse naturally, pretty funny.
Love that.
Well, you know, do you remember, Hyde, when our first show together at Mountain View College, you know, so.
Yeah.
And then we had, so I had managed, I made a friend.
Oh my God, that's right.
Colorado, and she had said she was going to come visit the show, and I was like, well, that'll never happen. But she did, and then she brought like half the board of the Whitney with her, and we're like,
oh my God.
Yeah.
Is this happening? Oh, like,
wow. And you sold some work.
I did. I sold to some like well-known collectors, and
holy
I was
moly.
Shocked. I mean, nothing like that has ever happened since, but that shit can fucking happen.
Sure, sure.
You yeah. don't know. Never say never, no, for sure.
No, I met them, like, and I remember just, like, nothing happened for me, but it was like, they're right here. They're in this space. Like, it's kind of a trip.
And that goes to show, like, Corky's production can and does, mm-hmm. you know, those kinds of things happen all the time and in all different parts of the country and the world, and they do produce results, and they do, there are things that actually come out of them, which
I could have been on Broadway easily.
You could have
done it.
It ain't over. You'll be asked to revive your character of the ecstatic elf.
Cody, is there anything else you wanted to talk about before we wrap up?
No. I just appreciate you guys allowing me to come on and talk about this.
It's great to meet you.
Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Shall we just quickly talk about our next guest?
Is it Sarah Welsh?
It is, and she has chosen a movie I have been itching to cover, which is Jurassic Park. And I cannot wait to, like, peel all the layers of that film off, because it is so dense for, like, a popular culture kind of iconic movie. And I think it also was just, it's very nostalgic for me. So I'm just super excited to watch that one too. It's finally one that I've seen, which is quite rare. So.
And I don't think I've ever seen it.
Oh my God.
I think when it came out, I was doing other things.
This is brilliant. This is so. Oh, I wish I could be there watching it with you when you.
That would be an interesting first watch.
Yeah.
It's gonna be good. Yeah. It's gonna be good.
And Sarah's a Houston-based artist who works with Rizzo Printing and graphic novels, and she and her partner James have a printing press. I'm spacing on the name of it right now, but we'll get to that next episode.
Yeah.
But a really lovely person, a great artist.
I'm excited. Well, thanks again, Cody. This has been so much fun.
Thank you guys so much.
Yeah.
Guffman. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
hope to see you in person sometime.
Adios, guys. Bye, listeners. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.